You're listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.
John, thanks so much for joining us today. We're really glad that we could have you on the show and that we could pick your brain a little bit.
My pleasure. I hope there's some left to pick. Thank you.
In celebration of the third Fates Warning LP, Awaken the Guardian, there is now going to be a Blu-ray release of performances you did of that record live at Keep It True Festival and Prague Power. Have you got a chance to watch it yet?
No, really the only thing that I've seen is what Metal Blade released, one song, Fata Morgana, from Keep It True. Really, that's all I've seen. The only other thing that I've seen is when Jim and I, we went into the studio because there were some, of course, lead balloons that we had to touch up, especially coming out of my mouth. There are a couple, flatsies and sharps. So what we had to do, I'll say first off that we left a good 75-80% without touching anything, just so it had that nice, a live feel. So the percentage that I needed to fix, I would see some of the video clips because I had to make sure whether it was one word or two words that I had to, that maybe it was too sharp and I had to fix. I had to be right on, so it didn't look like there was any lip syncing going on. So really, that's all I saw, little bits and pieces, but I have not seen everything that has been like a finished, finished editing and all that stuff.
Well, you did get to live the experience of performing these shows. And I got to ask, after so many years apart from the band, what was it like doing this in front of these huge audiences?
Well, leading up to it, it was one, giant panic attack for me. just taking into consideration that it had been 30 years since, wrote this stuff. And, my early 20s singing it, it was hard back then. So committing to these two shows was kind of a daunting task for me. And especially when I committed to it, and then they told me, it was going to be filmed live. It's like, you guys are pretty smart, because they know I probably, that definitely upped the ante a little bit. But so do me one favor, repeat that question again. So I tend to go off and make sure I want to answer you.
What was it like performing with this band that you haven't performed with in so long in front of these big, adoring crowds?
Okay. Okay. All right. That's where we were. Once the technical difficulties were, taken care of at, the first song or two were like, how it is up on stage. The sound is, it's never a way it was during sound check. So, but once the nerves settled, it was really great. I sort of wish that, we had done more gigs beforehand so I could actually get that live that live experience, because being off stage so long, you tend to forget that rehearsing versus live performance is such a different animal, and live is so much harder, but having said that, it was really great experience. All said and done, the fans were fantastic at both shows, especially the German fans are like rabid metal fans, and they were just over the top. But the fans were fantastic and really got, I think we fit off that energy. So it kind of brought me back to a time where we were active playing. And I kind of thought to myself, well, why wouldn't anybody want to be up here? It's like it's kind of an experience that it's hard to explain. But it was very, very good. Thanks.
That's awesome to hear. So I did watch a little bit of a shaky YouTube footage of you performing at Prague Power, and though the audio quality was pretty bad due to like the cell phone it was being recorded from, I could tell that you were hitting these notes, these incredibly difficult high notes. You're well in your 50s now. How are you able to maintain that ability?
I don't know. I think it's the fear of God. you have to, when you commit to something and, you have to, I really just wanted to get my voice in some resemblance of, you know, what it was. And I didn't know. I hadn't sang, you know, this stuff. I mean, since Sympathetic Resonance, when we went out for those two dates, I sang some of Guardian. But yeah, daunting to try to do that again. But I just had to keep rehearsing. You know, there were good nights and there were like, you know, what's the name of the show? In the Toilet here? Yeah, there were some nights that were basically, yeah, in the toilet with my voice. So it was like inconsistency. And I wanted to get, you know, a little bit more consistent before I hit the stage to sing.
Do you have any specific warm-up techniques to get your voice ready? Drinking some tea or gargling some salt water?
You know what? I never really had any ritual to warm up, which is probably not a good thing. I do drink some like black root tea, you know, as I'm practicing. But you know what? I pretty much just put it on and go for it. And what I do is, of course, my voice isn't ready, and you know, it sounds like a squeaky car door. But then, you know, it'll work itself out. And you know, then you start, you know, you start hitting the notes, and you start getting your vibrato, you know, back. So really, no, I have, unfortunately, very little discipline when it comes to that. I just put it on. You know, sometimes I'll just put on, you know, Maiden, The Number of the Beast, or Queensrÿche Operation, Mind Crime, something like that, and I'll just start singing along with it and I'll just get as far as I can. Sometimes, you know, one night I would do all of Operation, I would do all of Number of the Beast, and then a couple songs off Sympathetic Resonance, which is a really good night because that's a lot of singing and a lot of high stuff. And then other nights, you know, really, there was a couple nights where I just said I had to actually say, you know what, I'm going up to watch TV. It's not working out right now. You know, it's better because once you strain yourself or whatever, if you have a viral thing like a cold, once you strain your voice, it's going to be like that for a little bit. So, but yeah, really no rituals per se. Just dive into it.
I know it's always funny to say to a singer, but you know, going back to, you know, Awaken the Guardian and seeing you perform live, like, you can really sing. You have a great singing voice. When did you know that you had talent?
No matter how many times people tell me that, I still like shake my head, like, you know, I don't know. It's just pretty much I just did what I, you know, did what I did, and I do what I do. I don't know. That's a tough one. I just basically do the best I can. And you know, like back in the day, it seemed to be like a natural progression. Earlier bands, I played guitar and I always sang, but not with that intensity. It's, you know, doing covers of Elton John and Grand Funk Railroad and things like that. So never that kind of intensity. But, you know, once, you know, I started with Fate's Warning, you know, once you get in front of an audience, it's like, I don't know, man, it's just adrenaline kicks in and all those feel-good chemicals like testosterone that I used to have kick in. And you just have to, like, power through everything. You know how it is. It's like you get up there, you got a really muddy monitor mix, and you have to sing over that stuff. And so you push so hard, you don't even realize you're pushing that hard. And it's amazing how much the voice can take, as long as you're singing with, you know, like, proper technique, you know, for the most part. So it was, to me, it was like a natural progression. It just happened. You know, by the time I got to Awaken the Guardian, you know, I don't know, I was just feeling good. I was feeling strong. We just come off some dates. And I had the live experience, which kind of, it's like going to the gym and lifting weights. It just makes you a stronger singer. So having all that, you know, in conjunction, I think it just came together in, you know, that era back there. You know, everybody was singing in the stratosphere, you know, with Jeff Tate and Crimson Glory and stuff. And I don't know what it was. Everybody felt the need, not everybody, but maybe I got caught up in that, felt the need to sing in a higher register. And, you know, naturally my voice is higher, but I certainly pushed the envelope and kind of boxed myself into a corner, you know, especially now, you know, being 57 and singing that stuff now, and, you know, your body is just not the same vehicle it used to be. But so I think it was just a progression, and I just kept pushing.
That's awesome. You know, I will admit that I'm a little bit younger, so I was less familiar with Fate's Warning's material until I interviewed a band, a new band called Summerlands, who very much do the style of progressive or traditional metal, whichever you'd prefer to call it. And he could not stop saying nice things about Fate's Warning, specifically the John Arch era of Fate's Warning. Did you have any idea that you would be influencing like brand new bands coming up now at this stage in the game?
Oh, no. No, at the time, we were just a bunch of long-haired guys, man, doing what they were doing and enjoying what we were doing. And I call it blind ignorance. We didn't know much about the industry, and we didn't care. It was obviously not about the money. It was about, you know, the passion for music and doing what we were doing. And it wasn't really until social media came into play where, you know, we could actually physically read what people were saying. And we certainly got feedback at the shows and everything, and it was, you know, really encouraging and stuff, but to the you know, the intensity of it really wasn't realized until after social media and people were you know, commenting and you know, and how much of an influence this was, and what, you know, the album was like some kind of landmark or something. And you know, I don't know what it is about me, but I just think of it in terms as it is what it is, and it's something that we're just doing back then. And it was a product of the times and just the energy and, you know, vision that we had, you know. And yeah, there was some, definitely, you know, Jim's a talented songwriter. He came down with, you know, chord constructions and, you know, it made it what it is. And I think it was, you know, it was different for that time period. A lot of people say, oh, you were behind your time, but we didn't know any of that. We were just doing what we're doing.
So by that same token of social media, seeing what people have to say, do you ever see just people saying horrible, mean things about you?
You know what? Not horrible, mean things, but, you know, there are fans of, you know, my era, I guess, if you want to call it the incarnation of Fates. And then there are fans of Ray, and then there's fans of both. Which I really appreciate the fans of both that have an open mind and can appreciate, you know, both style of singing. But really, nobody's really came out with anything, you know, like really hurtful or anything like that to say. Especially when, you know, on social media, people don't realize that that you say something about a band or a member, they could be reading it, you know, as you type it, and it's so funny because, you know, they'll say something. Well, just like, you know, I tend to see that. Somebody will pop a question, okay, Ray Alder or John Arch, you know, and then we get three posts down, and then there's like a fist fight that breaks out. You know? It's just like, you know, come on, man, aren't we like beyond that? It's just so funny, you know. So, but nothing mean spirited, like, oh, I don't like his voice because it's too thin or it's too high, or, you know, things like that. But I totally understand that, and it's not like I disagree. My voice is what it is. Certainly the recordings could have been done differently because, yeah, the mixes are really thin. And I don't really think it's indicative of my true voice. But I actually am trying, you know, my best now to use more of my range. Instead of worrying about singing in the stratosphere is what I was conditioned to do or what I conditioned myself to do. I'm trying something different. So, you know, I understand, boy, people are so different. And I never realized what one person hears, another person does not hear the same way. So I try not to take it. Yeah, maybe it hurts my feelings a little bit, but you can't, because, you know, for what I just said, people have different opinions about everything. And I could certainly understand somebody, they don't like my voice, totally understand it. Somebody likes Ray's voice better. I certainly understand it. He's got a really great, you know, warm, seasoned voice, and he sings a different style and in a different range. It makes us two different style singers, but I think it's all good, and I can appreciate fans that like both eras. So, no, I've actually been treated, you know, really well, you know, by fans, and even you know, people that like, oh, I like Ray better, and that's fine. You know, that's great. I think it's the way it should be.
You did a record just a couple of years ago with Jim. What was that like compared to recording these albums back 30 years ago? Technology, of course, has changed dramatically. Was it an entirely different experience for you?
Well, not entirely. I think the basic format of how we recorded and, you know, up in Jim's studio, that was all the same. It was unnerving because I hadn't done anything in a long time, you know. Well, Twist of Fate, of course, that was done quite a while ago, and then Sympathetic Resonance. You know, anytime I go, it's nerve-wracking. But yeah, one major difference is going from, you know, back in the day, recording analog, which was painstakingly slow. But on the other hand, I think analog has such a warmer ambient sound to it, whereas the first couple of notes that we recorded, excuse me, with Sympathetic Resonance, it's like, wow, digital is just like such a sterile, you know what I'm saying? Sterile sound, it cuts through glass, and it's so crystal clear. And I suppose it's not a bad thing per se, because you can manipulate the sound any way you want. But I prefer the analog sound for sure. The digital stuff, of course, you can fix things really quickly on the fly. So that was a new experience for me working with the digital stuff. But, you know, we pretty much took the same approach as far as how we wrote together and the recording. And, you know, thank God Jim is, we both have the kind of same work ethic where we're not rushing for dollars and cents, and we don't let anything slide that we really don't like. And I think we bounce stuff off each other really well. Which makes it a comfortable environment for me to work in. So it came back to us. It felt pretty natural. Of course, a lot older. And today it's a lot different with bands when we're scattered all over the place, you know. And we used to go down to rehearsals when we wrote stuff, and you could get a better feel for how things sounded, you know, with the band right there and bouncing things off each other. I mean, that was a better way to write, in my opinion. And so, you know, writing via emails, and then I would take trips up there for, you know, a day or two and work on it. So that's the major differences.
Gotcha. Well, you left the band, a long time ago, and basically making the decision to pursue a full-time job, your trade. There were two paths that you could have taken in life, and, you know, there was the one that you've lived with a family and a steady job and hobbies, and the other was a more unstable rock and roll kind of lifestyle. Do you have any regrets with the path that you chose?
No, I can say that pretty confidently. No, I don't, because, I know how much, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not complaining. I know how much, it's very rewarding with the music, but, you know, your life really isn't your own, I suppose, because, every day it's about the band. And I know a regular job is kind of the same thing, but you don't take that home with you. The music is just a constant revolving door of, okay, there's an album to be written, there's tours to be done, interviews, there's just always something going on. You're always traveling, and I'm not a homebody per se, but I kind of like my feet planted in the ground a little bit. I like to be able to live independently and have, you know, a steady income and being able to, you know, pay for our house. And so right now I'm in a good position, so I don't know if I would have been. It's a kind of a gamble. You don't know, because we came out with, you know, some good albums, doesn't mean that you're going to have, you know, a success rate all your life. It seems like with bands, there's just like football players, there's a certain longevity with them. Most cases, I mean, there are, you know, phenomenons where bands can make a living and a good income and consistently put out good albums, you know. And today it's usually, you know, bands, you know, reuniting after years being apart. But no regrets, not really. I mean, at one point, you know, when I auditioned for Dream Theater, I was considering, you know, getting back into it. But then, you know, things happened there too, which were beyond my control, really. And, I think everybody made out for the best. And I don't really have any regrets. I can go mountain biking anytime, road riding, ride my Harley. I can do a lot of things I'm freed up to do that I really enjoy. And especially at my age, you know, that's not something that I felt I could do forever. Even back then, I kind of had a taste of it where, I don't know, maybe I could see the direction. And a lot of bands today, unfortunately, with the environment, they do struggle. You know, it's hard. It's like really expensive to tour. It's expensive to make albums. People aren't, you know, like they used to be going out to concerts and stuff. So it's a tough environment. But that's really beside the point. I kind of had to make a choice where that road divided, and I took the path where I felt most, where my intuition took me, my gut feeling, and that's here.
When I was doing research getting ready for this interview, I went back and started listening to your different projects, and I actually came across something I didn't know you did. You actually did guest vocals for the band Dead by Wednesday. And
yeah.
For our listeners that don't know, Dead by Wednesday is a alternative metal band out of New Haven, Connecticut, former members of Gargantuous Soul. And if anyone's ever driven up I-95 right outside New Haven, there used to be an abandoned Toys R Us with Gargantuous Soul spray painted across the entire thing. I think they finally knocked it down.
Yeah, it sounds like Chris painting everything.
So how did you hook up with a band like that?
You know what? I'm not usually one that steps outside the box and, you know, just do these off projects with bands. And I don't know if maybe it was the alignment of the stars or whatever. I was at a bar. Maybe I had too many drinks and I was approached by the drummer, who's pretty much the high energy front man, drummer for the band. And, you know, he asked me, said, look, we're doing we lost our singer, but we're doing, you know, an album. And it's actually a lot of the proceeds are going to be donated to, you know, rehabilitation center for, you know, habitual drug users. And so I don't know. I just said, you know what, just send it to me and I'll see, you know, I'll see what it sounds like and if I'm into it. And of course, the guitar player at the time, Joey Vera, he's a young, I'm sorry, Joey Vera, I'll be all right. Joey Conception is his name. And he's just a prodigy as far as I'm concerned. I've always loved his playing. So he was in the band. So I think that's one of the reasons I lean towards, okay, I'll try something. So they gave me a song and it was pretty basic and simplistic. And but they already gave me the theme of, you know, what they wanted to do about drug addiction. You know, so Darkest of Angels came to me, and I started writing lyrics. And, you know, before you know it, I was like halfway done with the song. I said, well, I told them, yeah, okay, let's do it. So again, I went up to Jim's and I recorded some vocals. So I didn't get to spend a lot of time on it. It was probably the quickest thing I've ever done. And I'm glad I stepped outside the box and did something different. Everything I, you know, if I do something, it makes me feel good to be able to do something for any of the fans that want to hear something. So, yeah, so that's how I ended up doing that. And I ended up actually showing up at Toad's Place in New Haven, and they were doing a live show, and I hopped on stage with a friend of mine, and we did the song live, you know, and Carrie and Liz. Yeah.
So the key to get you to do guest vocals on anyone's album is just to troll around the bars around New Haven and see if they're in there.
Yeah, feed me shots. give me a bunch of shots.
I'm in Providence, so it's not out of the realm of possibility that I could just hop on down to I-95 and look around.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah, we were just in we actually travel to Rhode Island, you know, kind of frequently to see a friend of ours play. In multiple bands. He actually did a King Diamond tribute, my friend Andre Van Show. And man, it was absolutely killer. It was almost like seeing King Diamond, the stage set up in the whole nine yards. So,
oh, that's awesome. Was that at Mardi Gras? Is that the name of the place?
Yeah. Yeah. There was one at Mardi Gras.
I'm right down the road.
Oh, dude. If you ever get a chance to see him, I highly recommend it. The stage alone is just incredible. And they're really a great band. Andre's a great singer. So, little. You know, promotion for my friend. That's pretty cool, you know?
So I was reading a fairly old interview that you had done in which you mentioned that you grew up across the street from a graveyard, that you felt like it might have influenced some of your lyric writing, giving it kind of a mystical edge. Jordan was telling me about all kinds of crazy ghost stories of Connecticut. Have any of them found their way into your writing as well?
I think the early stuff, especially when I was writing about mythological things, you know, there are so many, you know, the things of the Salem witch burnings and Devil's Hop Yard. And, you know, of course, I had mentioned that in some of the songs. There's hollows and haunted towns, and I'm sure that's like that everywhere, but there are legends and myths that live on, you know, to this day that, you know, it's always for a metal band is an interesting, you know, subject matter to hit, you know?
Yeah.
But living across from a graveyard. Yeah. I you know, grew up, in very young and seeing burials going on, you know, just every other day, you know, you don't even realize what's happening. I guess you're so young and going to a Catholic school and seeing, you know, all the stuff that I saw. It was kind of a big influence in some of my early writings. Not so much today, but yeah, for sure.
That is awesome. I was particularly stricken by the legend of the melon heads. Is that one that you've heard of before?
No, I never heard of that. No, it sounds funny though.
It's like a group of people that live out in the woods in like central Connecticut that, like, from decades of inbreeding, they have like enlarged heads and yellow eyes and like pale skin.
That I wouldn't doubt. That's got to be true. Especially in certain areas around here, for sure.
That'd be a great concept album.
Yeah, you're right. Wow, that's interesting. I'm going to have to look that one up. Just like you were watching all those horror shows, and now I'm determined to get to the bottom of the melon heads. You know?
There's just so many cool Connecticut weird things, like I said, the melon heads, and there's also Dudley Town.
I heard of that. Yeah.
Okay, that's like the town was settled, and then people mysteriously died and disappeared. Yeah, like everyone abandoned it, and people can sneak out there at night, and there's like no sound. It's very cool.
Ooh. Yeah, no birds, no crickets, and all that stuff. It's pretty cool.
A big thanks to John Arch for sitting down and talking with us chuckleheads. Let's play a track, a live track, from that upcoming Blu-ray. This is Fata Morgana.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you so much.
I've got a special guest today. My normal co-host, 365 Days of Horror, is out of town doing something or other. He told me and I forgot, and I'm a bad friend for that reason. So instead, I've got with me today the host of Full Metal Hipster Podcast, Shane Mathis, here to help us talk about the issues of the day, as it were. How's it going, Shane?
It is going good. How are you?
You know, I'm doing well, man. It's a beautiful day outside, taking the dog for a walk, doing the whole thing. How about you?
Same. I just actually got back. My girlfriend and I went out this afternoon. We went and saw an art exhibition from Raymond Pettibon. I don't know if you're familiar. He's the guy
Black Flag.
He had a big art expo or whatever you want to call it in New York for the last month, and today was the last weekend, so I was like, okay, I got to make it out. So I did that this weekend, and now I'm talking to you.
How was the exhibition?
It was good. I'm mostly familiar with his work for like Black Flag and the Circle Jerks and Sonic Youth, but I'm somewhat familiar with his more political oriented kind of stuff. And I wasn't aware of this at all, but he did a bunch of kind of semi-autobiographical artwork too, like dealing with his childhood and growing up. So that was interesting to see. It was good.
You know, I'm not 100% on the details here. I'm dealing with like secondhand information or from maybe a book that I read 15 years ago. So Raymond Pettibon, is that Greg Ginn's brother?
I don't know. Yeah, there's some familial connection. They're cousins or stepbrothers or something. I'm not 100% sure what their relationship is.
I do know that there is no love lost between the two of them. I believe that Greg fucked Raymond out of like a lot of money for the artwork.
Which
he did with like everybody on SST Records. So. It's not.
Yeah.
In addition to your work with Full Metal Hipster, you also sometimes write for Metal Injection, in which you do a really good job bringing out the worst actors in metal to basically scream your name in rage.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, I don't write so much anymore because I. My day job is writing, so I don't know. It's hard for me to come home and write after I've written like 2,000 words that day. but yeah, occasionally I'll still write something for Metal Injection. I've contributed to Noisy too. I've written a few things for Invisible Oranges. That's been a few years though. So yeah, really the only thing that I am kind of like driven or enthusiastic about doing is writing things that are going to make dumb metalheads really mad. So I don't know. It's kind of that thing where it's funny. If you have a cat, like if anybody listening has a cat, I'm sure that they know what I mean, where you just pester a cat until it gets really mad at you and then it's funny.
I've never done that to my cats, but my friends do that to my cats.
yeah, and it's super easy to make heavy metal fans angry, because for as fun as a lot of the music is, heavy metal fans have no sense of humor, or really just like no. I don't know. Like one of the last things I wrote, this is last year, was a rundown of what I consider to be the best black metal band in every state of the country. And of course there were people pissed off in the comment section because I didn't include any like Nazi bands.
Oh, yeah, I think I remember that now, that someone was like, this is an insult that you didn't include Grand Belial's Key.
Yeah, it's like, it's not an insult because, I mean, they aren't that good. Like, Grand Belial's Key is not that good of a band. I mean, yeah, they get credit for being one of the first black metal bands in the United States, but fuck them other than that. I mean, even if they weren't like shitty, like anti-Semites and racist, their music is just, and they don't do anything. They play Hell's Headbash like every other year, and that's like all they really do anymore. They try and play it off like, I, you know, they got rich though. It's not that I like them because I'm super racist too, but I mean, they really aren't that good. Like, their riffs aren't that good. People just don't want to admit that they're super racist, and that's why they're listening.
So I've had this thought for a while, and rather than just turning it over in my head, I'm going to speak it out loud, because that's how it gets out into the world. It's like the secret, you know. If you say it out loud, it becomes true. So I've been thinking for a while. I'm not terribly good at music, and it's taken me, you know, a long time to come to that realization. I just suck at all of it. That's why I write about it instead of, you know, writing actual music. But I would like to participate somehow, in some way, in some little scene in metal, just to make my mark. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to find the most obscure black metal band that nobody's ever heard of. Like, nobody's ever heard of it. The band themselves probably wouldn't remember recording this. And I'm going to put it on a cassette and then play it through my shitty solid-state amp into a broken microphone. Add some cover art that has swastikas and maybe some Klansmen. And then shop it around to, like, Hell's Headbangers and Behold Barbarity and just sell a tape of someone else's music with a couple of swastikas on it, collect a couple $100 and become a cult underground icon, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you could do that. Just record, I don't know, fucking around on a guitar, just like strumming a guitar really quickly into one of those old, like, play school cassette recorders.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Have you ever heard Tetragrammicide?
Probably. It sounds familiar.
It's way closer to noise than actual black metal, but using all the tropes of black metal. I'm pretty sure that that's exactly what they did. So, I mean, there is obviously a market here. They were selling, like, you know, they sold out of limited edition gatefold LPs of this shit, so. that's my next move, personally.
Yeah, it's funny for how underground a lot of black metal bands want to be. They're like super consumer oriented, where it's like, oh, it's limited edition and we're gonna have this like fancy layout. Like, okay. I mean, like, it's kind of hard to be underground, like, when you're hawking limited edition vinyl on your Facebook page. I don't know. I mean, I'm not shitting on anybody. I mean, you got to make money, and, you know, if there's a market for it, whatever. But it's just funny that it's like, oh yeah, we're a cult underground black metal band, visit our Facebook page.
Let's see, who was the band? Recluse, were you familiar with them? Phil McSorley.
Yeah.
They did have their music on the internet for a while, and you could easily purchase their music from their Facebook page, until one day they decided that that shit's queer and we're not doing it no more.
That sounds about right. Also, their music is, like, Recluse is not even that good. Like, Cobalt is way better, or was way better. I didn't like Slow Forever, but, yeah, I mean, when McSorley was in Cobalt, I mean, he was still a piece of shit, but at least he made good music.
Yeah, I mean, but the riffs, bro.
Yeah, I know. Them riffs, though.
365 published a post on Friday. He discovered, and he shared this with me, and it's pretty funny. The new vocalist of Stuck Mojo has terrible opinions about fucking everything. Like, just if...
Oh, God, yeah.
And which is funny to me. Like, for a decade now, I've been shitting on this band for being god-awful. And I had no idea that there were bad politics to back up the terrible music. So I feel, like, vindicated all of a sudden. Basically, 365 called him out for being, I don't know, racist and sexist and Islamophobic. And he invited him to defend his views on the podcast, and he accepted. So in a few weeks, we will have the vocalist of Stuck Mojo, of all fucking bands, on this podcast to debate every horrible opinion in the world.
That's awesome.
But we published this, and on Facebook, we immediately got a couple of mouth breathers like, oh, what's Islamophobic about saying that you don't trust Muslims?
Like, I mean, that's kind of the definition of it.
Yeah, it's like you're all basically like virtue signaling libtards or what? I don't know, man. It's ridiculous. People really want to be vindicated in their bigotry, just like I want to be vindicated that Stuck Mojo is a terrible band.
Yeah.
The difference is that, like, it's okay to, like, make fun of music. It's not okay to be like, oh, yeah, all Muslims are bad.
Yeah. I mean, music, yeah. Music is a creation. It's not who, it's not a person, or it's not, like, who you are.
And by that same token, like, there are no bands I think that I would defend. Like, I don't care about a single band enough or an artist enough to be like, yo, no, it's not that bad. Growing up, I was a big Pantera fan, but, like, I don't love the band enough to be like, yeah, Phil Anselmo, he's a cool dude. Obviously not. I don't know. Is there anybody that you're a fan of that if it came out that they were like, maybe all Puerto Ricans should be jailed, you would defend them?
No, not really. I mean, I am like you in the sense that I don't agree with, like, venerating art or artists or really anybody. I mean, art, there shouldn't be art that's beyond criticism, and there shouldn't be beliefs that are beyond criticism. Like, you should be able to, I think you should be able to shit on anything. I mean, obviously, like, people do. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, maybe if Joey Ramone were still alive and he was like, oh, yeah, I've been reading some stuff on the internet. I'm not sure the Holocaust happened. I mean, that would bum me out. Or, well, I don't
wasn't,
know.
Wasn't Joey kind of a right winger?
No, that was Johnny. Oh, so okay. Joey was like a liberal, and Johnny was like a Reagan conservative. And so a lot of Ramones songs, especially in the 80s, the lyrics that Joey wrote came from that. Like, Bonzo Goes to Bitburg.
Love that song.
I mean, it's about Reagan, and it's kind of like a dig at Johnny. Because Johnny stole Joey's girlfriend and married her, too. Well, I don't know. He didn't steal her. I mean, you can't steal somebody. But they had, like, an affair, and they wound up getting married. And that's what the KKK Took My Baby Away is kind of about.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God. I had no idea.
So they didn't really – I mean, from what I understand – I mean, they worked together, but I don't think they had much of a, like, a friendship or much of a relationship at all outside of the band.
Interesting. My favorite Ramone, hands down, is Dee Dee, R.I.P. simply for his hip hop track Funky Man.
Oh God, that album is so bad.
Well, the thing is, and I know a guy who fucking spent like $300 on the vinyl of that because it's so rare.
Yeah, D.D. King, his rap alter ego.
That shit rules, man. Like, that video for Funky Man puts me in a great mood every time I watch it.
Yeah, it's just, it's impossible. I don't know if he was just goofing around or if he was just strung out on heroin so much and was like, oh yeah, this is a good idea.
Oh, that actually explains a lot.
Yeah.
Now, you've been doing your podcast for a pretty good while now. How long has it been?
Just over 2 years. I started in right at the beginning of March in 2015. So, yeah, it's been about 2 years and a month or two.
What do you think you've learned, like, from starting to where you are now by doing the podcast?
It's a pain in the ass to try and deal with black metal musicians because they all, like, want to take themselves too seriously.
I believe that. I'm pretty picky about who we have on this show. If I don't think that they've got a sense of humor, I generally just don't even want to deal with them. Because I've got no interest in being serious whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, I'll have... It depends. I mean, the focus of mine is more just... It's for me. I want to talk to people who I think are doing interesting things or who I like as you know, I like their music and they seem cool. You know, I just interviewed Wino for the episode that's coming up this week. And like, he's super cool. I found out that his family is from like the same area in Ohio my family is from. But yeah, just like that, there's not really any rhyme or reason. I'll do big name musicians if it's somebody that I'm personally interested in, but I don't try and set up interviews just because I think it's going to attract an audience or more listeners, because I want to talk to people that I have questions for and I want to like learn about and stuff. So yeah. So it's like, I'll talk to Wino or like Barney from Napalm Death. And then the next episode is some like obscure noise rock band from Iowa or something. I don't know. It's just whatever I want to do.
I guess the thing that I notice about metal podcasts, aside from yours and mine, of course, is that they're terrible. And the options there are pretty limited. Like, I guess the Joe Rogan of metal would be Jamie Josta.
Yeah, I could see that. that makes sense, I think. But yeah, a lot of metal podcasts are just glorified playlists. Like, they'll just play some music and then say a few things in between, and I don't find that entertaining.
Yeah, that was kind of how this one started, but that was, you know, like 50 something episodes ago. And I decided that I wanted to be the Chapo Trap House of metal, which has paid out not in the least bit for me.
Yeah. You mean you don't have a $50,000 a month Patreon yet?
I'm working on it, you know. Pretty soon we'll do some bonus episodes, and then just the money will come just fucking pouring in.
Yeah, it's just going to be like somebody open the floodgates. Yeah, I don't know. I do the interview episode, and then I'll do a playlist episode with like five songs in it. I don't really do them every week. I'll try and do them every other week or so, because it's a lot of extra work for no money. But I don't know. It's kind of a split between the people that listen to Full Metal Hipster. Some people prefer the interviews. Some people prefer the playlist. So I try and mix it up, because I don't want to do one 2-hour long episode, because nobody's going to listen to that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, you say that again, I go back to Joe Rogan. He does like a 3-hour episode a week.
Yeah, I don't listen to Joe Rogan. I don't really listen to my patience runs out around the hour mark, unless it's something really interesting. I do feel like an hour is about the sweet spot. Although people love hardcore history, and the latest episode of that is 5 hours long.
Get
so
the fuck out of here.
Yeah, no, I'm serious. I can't remember what his name is. I haven't listened to it yet because it's 5 hours long, but it's something about the history of World War II. I think it's like the entire history or something. So there's a lot to it.
I just can't even imagine exporting a file that big. Like, our own show takes up like a gig on my computer.
yeah, I know. Yeah, he's got to have a dedicated hard drive. And how much research would you have to put into that? I mean, that would take forever.
I mean, I would just probably fudge it like around hour two.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then aliens came down and wiped out the Nazis.
It was the Battle of the Dutchman's Wheelbarrow.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Don't look that up. Just take my word for it.
But yeah, I think that we're probably roughly about that part of the show where nobody's listening anymore. So you're free to like say like something super fucked up.
Okay. I don't even know. the Jews are responsible for all wars.
I kind of suspected it all along, man. It's yeah. Them and the Puerto Ricans. You can't trust them.
Yeah. They're all dangerous. I mean, I don't know. That's a lie. I'm not really super. I'm only a little racist. I'm not super racist.
What would you mean by a little racist?
I don't know. I didn't think that through. That just came out. I everybody is fine. I just don't like Haitians. Everybody else is fine.
I really hope that, like, the people that write mean articles about you on Death Metal Underground or whatever just chop up this interview to sample it together. Like, I hate Haitians, I'm racist.
Oh, they told me, but one time I took... No, one time I tweeted something, a joke about Staten Island. It was, I can't even remember. It was something like Staten Island is 90% Italian stereotypes. And yeah, no, they wrote something about it, like how I was racist.
See, they do it too.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. I never know. Just periodically something about me will show up on that website and I never know what's going to trigger it. And it's always, I always feel honored. I think there's 5 articles about me there now. I have my own hashtag.
What, really?
Yeah.
Let's see what we got. SJW's Whine About Trump's Triumph.
By, oh yeah. Yeah. That's, I'm in there.
By Daniel Morat, who sounds Jewish. Yeah. Hashtag Metalgate defies critics, continues growing. That's pathetic, and that definitely holds up over time. Who wrote this one? Brett Stevens. Oh, the OG. Funny fact about Brett Stevens. He's a medical miracle. Only baby to ever be conceived and delivered anally. I'm a little jealous of all of this attention that you've gotten from these chuds, like, because I feel like I do a lot of writing about, you know, sensitive topics that would piss off knuckle draggers, but nobody's targeted me. But they come after you. They come after Joseph Schaefer of Invisible Oranges.
Weird.
Yeah, and Grim Kim, and like that's.
Oh yeah, yeah.
These guys. I'm here too. Is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, you gotta. I don't know what it is. It was one article in particular I wrote. Like, was it? Has it been 3 years or 2 years? I don't know. A few years ago, and it was one of the articles. It was that stupid Metalgate thing that happened. I don't know if you remember that because it lasted like 3 days.
I don't remember.
Oh yeah. So I mean, this is so stupid. But you know, you remember that Gamergate bullshit?
Yeah, yeah.
It was a spinoff of that.
And okay, I do remember a little bit, because I think that David Draymond like tried to hitch his wagon onto this as well.
Yeah, he did. And actually, yeah, that's actually funny because I actually accidentally caused that guy to get bombarded with like Nazi apologists on Twitter. Because he posted something about how he was like, oh, I'm with blah blah, like Gamergate or whatever, and I didn't think he was gonna respond, and I tweeted at him like, you know, tons of those guys are just anti-Semitic, right? They're just neo-Nazis. And then he responded, and he was like, what? Oh, that's crazy. And then I don't know. I tweeted a few examples at him of articles and memes and stuff that were like super, you know, like, ah, ha, ha, send the Jews to the oven. Ha, 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 kind of stuff. And, he like retweeted me or he quote tweeted me and was like, I don't know, Gamergate, what do you think? So, I got inundated with hate for like a week after that on Twitter. But then the side effect was that was a whole bunch of people tweeting at him. Well, you know, the Native Americans use the swastika first, or like that kind of stuff. And so he was arguing with those people. Somebody made a Storyfy of it. It's probably not around and you probably can't read it anyway because he deleted his Twitter account. But so that was pretty funny.
That's awesome. It's actually a symbol of peace in the Hindu.
Yeah,
movie.
No, that's what they were saying.
Yeah.
Well, it's not just the Nazis who use it.
I mean, I happen to use this because the Nazis use it, but it's also yeah.
it also has alternate usages.
Yeah, like I don't know, edgy dudes like trying to reclaim it for people of color or something like that. That's my favorite shit. Like, no, I got the swastika tattoo because it's one of the earth, and I'm taking it back from the Nazis.
Yeah, and people like that, I just assume that they're actually neo-Nazis, and they're just trying to hide behind that, because who wants to – nobody's ever going to – who's going to reclaim the swastika?
Some woke dipshit from, like, Bushwick. He's going to reclaim it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, knock yourself out. More power to you, I guess. I guess long story short is I wrote an article one time, and it was those, like, stupid Gamergate people picked it up, like that Sargon of Akkad guy did one of his stupid screaming YouTube rants about it. And that's where a lot of that attention came from. So just figure out the next outrage, the next the next thing that nerdy white guys are interested in. The next time they get mad about, like, social justice warriors invading it or whatever, just write an article sort of tangentially related to it and put it on Reddit or something, and then a whole bunch of people will, like, pester you for weeks and months.
I think I got it, because, I mean, I can't tell which way the weather's going to blow with these guys, what's going to really get in their craw, but it seems like at the moment the hot button issue is pedophilia, and that number one, Pizzagate is a real thing that's happening, and that all of these pedophiles need to be, like, thrown out and punished for running these pizza restaurants that are also somehow pedophilic torture dungeons. Also that Milo did nothing wrong.
I totally forgot about that. Yeah, it's a shame that he got thrown off of Twitter before that happened.
It's great. Milo Yiannopoulos is just, like, slowly – he's like the fucking picture of Marty in Back to the Future, slowly disappearing without getting attention all the time.
I know. Yeah. What is he? He's off Breitbart. Twitter needs to kick off Cernovich too. That guy's even worse, actually.
I hate him so very much. He's everything wrong with America in one instance. Like, he's a rapist, number one.
Yeah. That's the main thing.
And I remember that he wrote some tweet mocking Trayvon Martin for being dead because he said that he wouldn't be able to, like, grow up so he could rape, which is awfully ironic coming from an actual rapist. Anyway, where I was going with this is that pedophilia is, like, a hot-button issue for these guys, probably because they're all, you know, quietly holding tons of child porn on their computers and they should all be investigated. I need to write something about don't forget, Ted Nugent, child fucker.
Yeah, you could do that. I mean, it wouldn't be wrong. It's true.
Just calling out the child fuckers of Metal, that guy, the dude from Dope, Jimmy Page. Jimmy Page, like, a notorious child fucker.
Well, I mean, David Bowie did too. I'm pretty sure if you were a rock star in the 70s, you were, like, into some seriously debauched stuff.
Yeah, man. Don't you wish we could go back to those days, man, where, like, just rock was pure and they could, you know, fuck children?
Back when you could get your cheese pizza at any show. I don't know.
That's when music was real, man. Not any of this pussy shit today. There you have it. Classic rock is just a pining for days when you could have sex with children. That's my hot take, and I will write that.
Do that. And then what you have to also, I mean, if you're going to do it, you also have to post it into, like, a MGTOW forum on Reddit, or like a Meninist forum, or wait until the next movie where they gender flip a male character. And then when all the men's rights guys get really angry about it, just write an article that's somewhat tangentially related to it for Toilet of Hell, and then put it in like Men Going Their Own Way or something.
Yeah, and then I'll send it to Phil Labonte, and he'll do the work for me.
Yeah, that guy blocked me. I'm so pissed.
Wait, really?
Yeah, he did. It was because I said it. I can't remember. It was whatever one of the last horrible things he said on Twitter. I think it was when he was just, like, throwing around a whole bunch of like homosexual slurs.
Yeah, yeah.
I just said something about how he looked like a baby that people. He looked like a baby that took HGH, and he blocked me.
That's so funny. He still hasn't blocked me.
I
would have blocked me if I was him.
Yeah, that's impressive. I mean, I've said other stuff to him before, and I've had interactions with him because, like, he hates metal injections. So if he knows that, like, I've written stuff not about him, but just kind of name checked him, so he got mad about that. But he blocked me because I said he looked like a baby on HGH.
It is worth noting that Rob from Metal Injection is fucking stone cold about that shit too. He was making fun of Labonte for being divorced, which is which is really funny. I wouldn't have done that, but it's really funny.
Yeah. Well, they tried to get him, like Rob tried to get him to come on the Metal Injection podcast on multiple occasions, and he wouldn't do it. He was like, "You're just gonna re-edit it to make me look stupid." And he's like, "No, we don't edit anything. Like, if you come on, if you look stupid, it's your own fault." And the whole idea was, like, I forget what blow up it was, but it was ostensibly a debate. But he, like, Labonte wouldn't do it because he's a giant baby.
Is there anything that you would like to tell the adoring audience of Toilet of Hell before we call it?
Yeah, I mean, if you're into podcasting, check out Full Metal Hipster. I try and put out at least one episode every week, sometimes two. Like I said, the episode coming up is Scott Wino Weinrich. I occasionally write for Metal Injection and Noisy, and also, I don't know, if you're on the Twitters, you can follow me at MetalShane2000, MetalShane 2000. I mostly, like, yell about politics and how metal is ridiculous, so if that sounds appealing, then follow me there.
And that's why you're one of my favorite Twitter accounts.
Oh, thank you.
All right, everybody, we'll see you next week. Thanks so much.
listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.